The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And tonight on Where Did the Road Go, we're going to be doing something I've wanted to do since the beginning of this show. We're going to be talking with someone knowledgeable about Aleister Crowley. And it is Crowley, for anyone who doesn't know. And Aleister Crowley was a huge influence on my life from very early on, from somewhere in my late teens when I first discovered his work. And he's very misunderstood in the general public. And whenever I hear someone on show, let's say show similar to this one, it's usually someone who really doesn't understand Crowley and sometimes comes up with the most ridiculous things. So we're going to be talking to Joseph Thiep. You know what? I'm going to let him say his last name so I don't screw it up. Welcome, Joseph.
Hey, thank you for having me. My last name is pronounced Thebes.
Thebes. Okay, that's what I thought, but I just... All right, and you had started a page called Aleister Crowley 2012.
Yeah, that's right. That was kind of a parody, satire, art, magical working. It was also a political campaign to elect Aleister Crowley as president of the United States in 2012.
and you used it to kind of disseminate true facts about Crowley rather than all the non-true stuff that's out there.
Yeah, exactly. There were a number of posts I made up on the blog there. I guess I made posts on a number of topics, some of which, it was an exploration of Aleister Crowley's ideas about politics, but there were also a number of posts which specifically addressed the sort of the myths and slanders about Aleister Crowley that have been going around since his lifetime. There's been a lot of rumors for many, many years, really attacking Aleister Crowley's character and saying false things about him. And I wanted to kind of use the platform of this satirical, humorous website, which, you know, got a lot of attention, to kind of debunk some of those myths.
And it's still there, and people can check it out. It's, ac2012.com?
Yep, that's right.
And you have a lot of stuff up there, and you have some really cool merch up there, too.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, some T-shirts and stuff like that. I'm hoping they'll still be hip, even though it's 2013 now.
All right, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got interested in Crowley and what you're doing now?
Sure. Well, I guess I got interested in Aleister Crowley. I was pretty young. I grew up in a household that was fairly intellectual, and I was really exposed to a lot of philosophical ideas at an early age. And I guess I was about 14 years old, and I was playing role-playing games and card games and things like that. And I picked up the card game called Illuminati. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
No.
It's made by Steve Jackson Games. I was about 14 at the time, and I remember looking at it, and there was a really kind of thick rule book for it. And at the very end of the rule book, there was actually a bibliography. And I was looking at the bibliography, and some of these books seemed to be nonfiction books about the Illuminati. And I thought, what on earth? The Illuminati is real? How can that be? and so I was looking at the bibliography, and one of the books on the bibliography was Robert Anton Wilson, his book called Cosmic Trigger, mm-hmm. The Final Secret of the Illuminati. And I was in a university bookstore and happened to see this on the shelf and picked it up immediately, read it, had my mind blown. That was kind of my first introduction to the name Aleister Crowley, was it, because his name appeared many times in that book.
Right.
And so I tried reading a little bit of Crowley at that point, but, being 14, it was a little bit above my head. And, so I kind of just stuck with reading Robert Anton Wilson for a long time and then kind of moved on to Timothy Leary. But I kept trying to read Aleister Crowley, and I would, I worked with his tarot and I read what I could understand and picked up a lot of his books, actually, at an early age. And I was interested in Carl Jung as well, and I was reading some of his work. as well as Joseph Campbell. And one thing that I was really interested in was going through some kind of rite of passage, or, you know, some kind of magical ceremony whereby I could start to kind of go on the inward journey to discover my own individual nature as a human being. And I knew that there wasn't anything like that in Western civilization in terms of just, you know, the modern civilization. You know, I wasn't getting a rite of passage in high school. So I was interested in going through initiation. And I knew about Ordo Templi Orientis, but I didn't know if it existed or not back then. And I lived in Montana, so of course there was nothing like that there.
Right.
So I did go through initiatory ceremonies in Freemasonry, and when I was younger in Demolay, which is a kind of a junior Freemasonic order. But I wasn't really satisfied with that. I really felt like, it varies everywhere you go, but where I was at, it really felt like a lot of people were kind of just in it to trade business cards, and they weren't really paying attention to how the rituals were really transformative. And that was what I really wanted, was to, you know, work with people on esoteric, really magic. And so I kind of fell out of Freemasonry and was just doing work on my own, kind of developed a group of friends who were interested in similar things, and we did rituals that we would write ourselves and celebrate the seasonal transitions and so forth, until I guess I was about 25 when I moved to Portland, Oregon. And in Portland, you know, it's a larger city, of course, than anything in Montana. And when I got here, I didn't really know anyone else who was interested in magic or initiation or anything like that. And I'd kind of forgotten about Ordo Templi Orientis until I started thinking, like, gosh, where can I meet people who are interested in the same things I am? And then I remembered about OTO. And by then, Google existed. So I was able to go online and actually immediately find OTO and connect with them. And within a few months, I was actively involved and really found that the work that OTO was doing was exactly what I was really wanting to do. There were, you know, nobody was into it because they wanted to trade business cards, or it wasn't an old boys club. It was really a group of people who were getting together in order to perform rituals and help transform people's lives. So that's how I kind of got involved, and that was in 1999 that I first joined Ordo Templi Orientis, and that of course is Aleister Crowley really kind of founded the OTO as it exists today.
Right, and so. Of course OTO is short, is the abbreviation for that.
Right, exactly.
All right, let's talk about Crowley's early life. He was a part of the Plymouth Brethren growing up.
Right. Or really his parents were, and so he was by default.
Right.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
And they don't exist anymore, do they?
I think they do. I haven't looked really carefully at them, but I believe they still exist. They're small. But yeah, they were or are a very strict kind of fundamentalist Protestant group. And yeah, Aleister Crowley was raised strictly in that, and he actually, you know, was forced to memorize large sections of the Bible and things like that. And he greatly resented a lot of things about his upbringing.
And he was also criticized heavily for asking questions about the Bible as well.
Yes, very much so. Yeah.
So, but didn't he kind of revered his father, didn't he?
He did. I don't know exactly, you know, things that he's written about. I don't have quotes off the top of my head, but he really had a bad relationship with his mother.
Yeah.
Although on occasion there were good points about it. Pretty much Crowley hated his mother, and his mother was really the one who was really strict with him, especially after his father had died. Crowley felt really alienated by his mother, and eventually, I think, you know, his first break away from Christianity was in part because of his mother. But luckily, he found some other people that he worked with, and when he went off to school, he found a number of people that were more sympathetic to his views.
Yeah, but he definitely rebelled strongly against that. And his mother's the one who gave him the name the Beast, isn't she?
Yes, she used to call him the Beast, and later I think Aleister Crowley came to realize that there was more than just a nickname in that.
So the good part of the first part of his life, he was mountain climbing as well.
Yes, that's right. And he's actually gained quite a bit of fame as a mountain climber. In fact, I know a couple people who have a lot of Aleister Crowley's books, and they had some friends over once who were mountain climbers, and their friends saw these books by Aleister Crowley on the bookshelf, and they said, "Well, he writes books too? I thought he was just a mountain climber."
Wow.
So they didn't know about him except as a mountain climber. But yeah, he was part of the first European party anyway to climb K2, which is of course the second highest mountain in the world. So,
all right, and how did he get involved in the more esoteric elements of life?
Well, I don't off the top of my head recall the story of how he became interested in it, but he first joined the Golden Dawn when he was very young, early 20s. He joined the Golden Dawn and advanced very quickly through that, the esoteric order of the Golden Dawn in the UK. He advanced very quickly through that, it was right around the time of the Golden Dawn kind of breaking apart that he became active and excelled in it. And he kind of played a hand in the Golden Dawn falling apart as well. But yeah, so after the Golden Dawn fell apart, he went on to found his own orders. Of course, he also went to Egypt and received the Book of the Law, which is where we get the religion he founded called Thelema.
Right, right. Now, yeah. the Golden Dawn, do they still exist in some form today?
Yeah, the Golden Dawn, there's a few different groups that have formed. I don't think that there's a continuity back to the original Golden Dawn, because it pretty well broke up. But then since then, there have been a number of groups who have kind of tried to reboot it. There's actually a Thelemic Order of the Golden Dawn. Mm. There's an open source Order of the Golden Dawn, which I think is mainly computer geeks. Then there's also the one that the Cicero couple, I don't remember, Chick Cicero, and I don't remember her name, but they wrote a number of books about Golden Dawn stuff, and they have, I believe they do initiations and things too. So it's really kind of, some Golden Dawn revivals that exist out there.
Now, Crowley was really critical of the way they were doing things, wasn't he?
Well, yes. I think that he really saw that there was a lot of gossip and slander and politics and drama, like you get in any group of people.
Right.
But I think he was especially upset at the way that Mathers was being treated, and he was the head of the order at the time, and Crowley really sided with him, and a lot of other people were, against him. And that kind of schism just kind of broke apart the order.
Go on.
Oh, and I think then later Crowley and Mathers fell apart, and Crowley ended up going off and doing his own thing.
Okay, well, weren't he and Mathers kind of friends near the end as well?
That I don't know. Okay. Towards the end of Mathers, I believe Mathers died first. I don't know if they were friends later or not.
Okay.
A lot of these details too about all that are also kind of debatable as to to whether they were friends or not. But there's a great relatively new biography out there called Perdurabo, and that's by Richard Kaczynski, and that was put out well in the last few years anyway, and it's been meticulously researched, and I think he put 20 years of research into that book.
Wow.
I really think it's the best biography that's out there now.
Wow. Okay. There is so much contradictory information on Crowley out there.
That's true.
Uh-huh. and for everyone who knows, it is Crowley, and Crowley used to say rhymes with holy.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, he wrote a poem where he rhymed it with holy, and that's how we know.
So after the Golden Dawn, what happened? Now, one of the things, if I remember right, he was actually upset that they were hiding all these rituals from people.
Yes, and he really felt that secrecy was the enemy of truth, or mystery was the enemy of truth, and he felt that everybody should have the information about how to do magic, and so he sought to publish all of the material of the Golden Dawn, and he did so in a publication, a journal called The Equinox. And he put out 10 issues in the first volume, and that spans about 10 volumes of actual text, with a lot of, if not all, of the rituals of the Golden Dawn contained in it. I don't think it had the initiatory rituals, but it had all the magical instructions, how to do banishings and so on. And so when he published that, you know, a lot of the Golden Dawn people were really upset with him because that was supposed to be secret. But Crowley didn't feel like it was worth keeping secret, because this was information that everybody should have, is what he felt. Of course, in Crowley's orders, he has secrets, but they're not the same kind of secrets. He doesn't keep secret how to do magic. What he keeps secret are the kind of modes of recognition, so that people who are members of the organization can recognize each other. And the initiatory rituals themselves are secret because they're kind of like, well, they're meant to have a kind of a psychological impact on a person, and part of that impact is the surprise, not knowing what's coming next. Because that mystery of not knowing what's coming kind of puts you in a heightened state of awareness, so that then as the ritual progresses, the symbolism and the magic of it really makes a deep impression on you. So that's kind of why Crowley's rituals in the Ordo Templi Orientis are secret, but he doesn't keep secret things like what the teachings of the order are, or what, you know, how to do magic or things like that.
Now, he kind of redefined or more narrowly defined what magic is and what black and white magic is.
That's true. He came out with a definition, and he tried to really make his definition kind of a rigorous and almost scientific definition of what magic is. And in a way, he kind of reclaimed magic in the modern post-Enlightenment era by saying that magic, all magic is the act of causing change in accordance with your will. And your will is, you know, people say, well, what do you mean by your will? Is that just like whatever you want? But I think Crowley meant by will that it's really your inmost nature. So in other words, when you do magic, it's anything that's actualizing your inmost nature and making that manifest in the world. And he even uses examples like writing a book in itself is a magical act, and you take magical weapons such as the pen and the paper, and you go into holy meditation by thinking about what you're going to write, and then eventually you call up demons like the publisher and you get them to do your work for you, you know, making sure that it gets out there in the world. And so anything, he says, any intentional act is a magical act. And, you know, he, in one letter, he writes to someone who asked him why anybody should do magic, and he says, well, you're going to do magic anyway, so you may as well practice and get good at it.
And the difference with him with black and white magic, to him, black magic was anything that involved the material world, whereas white magic was anything that was spiritual and aimed toward higher levels of consciousness, correct?
Oh, no. Actually, that's a great question, though. What he really defined black magic to be is anything which is which takes you away from doing your true will,
okay,
or takes you away from sort of manifesting your inmost nature, which could be material, but it could also be spiritual. You know, if you have like spiritual pride or something along those lines, where you're
okay,
if you do something that's spiritual, but it actually takes you away from your material needs. If you do anything which takes you away from fulfilling your will, that's kind of what he saw as black magic. And that includes, you know, interfering in someone else's will by, you know, say, forcing someone to fall in love with you, for example, when that's not really in their nature to do, that would be black magic.
Okay.
And he really defined white magic as anything which is in line with your will. And it's an interesting distinction, because kind of the way you described it would be a definition that would be applicable for about the last 4,000 years prior to Crowley, going back to Plato, where basically you have this kind of this dualistic idea where the spirit is exalted and the flesh is considered evil. You have this kind of dualism, and everything that spirit is exalted and everything that's flesh is avoided. Whereas Aleister Crowley, when he came around and received the law of Thelema, it kind of collapsed this dualism, because it really sees the body and the spirit and the mind as united holistic parts of an entire spectrum of being, which is all divine. And so the idea is that you want to manifest your true nature, and that is in its totality, material, mental, intellectual, emotional, and spiritual. So yeah.
Okay. All right. That's actually a way better definition, honestly. I haven't actually read Crowley. I haven't studied Crowley's stuff in quite a few years, so some of it
sure.
I'm a little rusty on.
Well, I have studied Crowley very extensively for many years, so some of this stuff is like I'm just like rattling stuff off that I've said a lot of times, so this is no problem at all.
Good. So after the Golden Dawn, he moved on to what?
Well, he in 1904, he kind of was of the mind of setting magic aside and kind of taking up the life of a bourgeois family man. And he met a woman named Rose Kelly, who was betrothed to someone as an arranged marriage that she didn't want to marry. And Aleister Crowley said, well, we could just go get married right now, and then they wouldn't be able to marry you off to this other guy, and you could go do whatever you want. I'm not going to hold you to, you know, being a stay-at-home, cook for me and clean for me. You can go do whatever you want. Just it'll be a marriage in name only, and that way I'll kind of save you from this situation. So she said, great. They went off. They eloped, and then they fell in love. And so they went off on a honeymoon to Egypt, and Crowley had. He wasn't an aristocrat, but he had a substantial amount of money for a while anyway that he used to go on honeymoon with her for quite some time. And while they were in Egypt in 1904, it was early spring 1904, they stayed. He kind of bribed some guards and so forth to get them into the Great Pyramid, and they got to go up into the King's Chamber. For their honeymoon, and he wanted to impress her with magic at that point. And he hadn't been practicing magic in a while. He had started doing the Abramelin operation back in Scotland, but kind of abandoned it. So he was going to just kind of impress her by evoking the sylphs to light up the interior of the chamber. Which he did, and they lit up the chamber, and she wasn't impressed apparently. But she did go into a trance at that point, which he thought was strange, because she hadn't had any magical experience and had no interest in magical things. So he was a little confused by the fact that she went into a trance, and he didn't really quite believe her at first. He thought maybe it was an act.
Mm-hmm.
But she kept saying things like, it's all about the child, and they're waiting for you, and this kind of thing. And he thought, okay, so who's waiting for me, or what's the child? And she said, it's Horus. And she said something, I don't remember the exact phrasing, she said something about how he was upset with Crowley for not having invoked him. And Crowley remembered that he hadn't. And that was kind of the first thing that led Crowley to think, maybe there's something to this. And so, and forgive me, I don't have all the details, you know, memorized, but he and she then went to the Boulak Museum, which is now the Cairo Museum in Egypt. I don't know the current state of that, by the way, since the riots and everything, but that was the one that was getting broken into and stuff during the recent riots. But but they went to that museum, and I don't think it was in the same location, but he said, okay, so Horus is talking to you. Why don't you show me who Horus is in here? Point him out to me. So they walked around in the museum for a while, and they passed a whole bunch of images of Horus, and she didn't point at any of them, and he thought, oh, well, she obviously doesn't know what she's talking about. But then she pointed at one all the way across the room, and she said, there he is. And so they walked over to it, and sure enough, here was one of the forms of Horus on this stele. It's a funeral stele, which is like a grave marker in a way. And it has a prayer written on it, written in the voice of the dead, the dead person. And this was the funeral stele of Ankhafna Khonsu. And Crowley noticed that the catalog number on the, because each of the pieces in the museum had a little number attached to it, and then you could look it up in the catalog and read about it. And this number was 666. And he thought, well, that's pretty odd. And then he proceeded to ask her a series of, I don't know, it wasn't 20 questions, but it was a bunch of questions about Horus, like what his color was and, you know, what his number was and things like this. And she got all of those questions correct, according to the Golden Dawn teachings of the correspondences. And so he thought, okay, they're waiting for me. Tell me what to do. What am I supposed to be doing? What are they waiting for me to do? And she said, well, you have to do this ritual, and here are the instructions. Gave him all the instructions for the ritual, and it was odd because the instructions for the ritual were kind of opposite everything that he would have assumed it should have been. Like, you're supposed to do it in this hotel room with an open window and a single chair and all these different things that normally you wouldn't do, you know, an invocation in a hotel room with an open window. But he went ahead and did the whole ceremony as she described it, and on three successive days he did it at noon, and on each of these days, as soon as he finished the ritual, the invocation of Horus, a voice came and dictated to him for 1 hour on each of the three successive days, and he wrote down everything that the voice said, and this transcription became the Book of the Law, which is kind of like the central holy text of the religion that Crowley founded, called Thelema. And so once Crowley started Thelema, at first he didn't take it seriously.
He completely denied it initially, didn't he?
Yeah, and he had had a lot of training as a Buddhist. You know, when he was doing his mountain climbing in the East, he got a lot of exposure to Buddhism, as well as a little bit to Taoism. And he really felt like he identified as a Buddhist for a while. And some of the stuff that was in the Book of the Law that he received, it really rubbed him the wrong way, and he saw that it was completely conflicting with some of the teachings he had as a Buddhist. And so he just kind of set it aside and didn't think much of it. And then many years later, I don't remember what happened exactly. Something happened that he went back and decided to go looking for that transcript again, and he pulled it up, and he started realizing that there was something to this. And I think it wasn't until 1915 that he fully accepted his role as the person who brought this kind of new revelation to mankind. He really felt like this was a revelation in the same way that say the Ten Commandments or the New Testament were revelations to humanity. And in some ways you could even look at the Book of the Law as being kind of it relating to Christianity in the same way that Christianity relates to Judaism, that it kind of overturns all the previous laws and establishes a new law. And so from the point in 1915 that he really accepted his role as the Great Beast 666, he then, you know, kind of created, he had been initiated in OTO already prior to the fact that he took it over, that it existed, and he decided to revise the rituals of the OTO and start a new order called the AA, which is modeled after the Order of Golden Dawn. And both OTO and AA became Thelemic orders. So he incorporated the teachings of the Book of the Law into the core of the rituals of these two orders. And OTO is kind of modeled, it isn't really Freemasonry at all, but it's kind of the structure of it is similar to Freemasonry, while the structure of AA is similar to Golden Dawn.
Okay.
Yeah.
One of the things I found really interesting, and I was looking to reread his autobiography and find the bit where he had the chamber light up in the Great Pyramid, because, for instance, the guest we had on here last week, Gary Evans, researches the acoustic properties of places like that.
Interesting.
And apparently the entire King's Chamber is set to vibrate to sound.
Huh.
The acoustic properties through the whole Great Pyramid are all sound-oriented, and a lot of people, including Gary, now believe that it's meant to alter your consciousness.
Wow, interesting.
And
well, that's, That wouldn't surprise me. I mean, the Egyptians were into a lot of interesting stuff that we still don't fully understand, and I wouldn't be surprised at all. It's too bad, you know, I mean, it's probably was a lot easier back then to get into the King's Chamber than it is today, but I would love to do some experiments like that.
Yeah, well, you can get in, but it's limited time, and yeah, it was a lot easier back then.
Yeah.
Because I don't think you're going to be easily spending the night in there like he did.
Right, exactly. You'd have to be... coming up with a lot of backsheesh, what they call the bribe money.
yeah. Now, one of the things that he gets criticized for here and there is his kind of his view of women, which seems to be contradictory here and there throughout his writings.
Yeah, that's a good point. He really was very conflicted about women, and, you know, to say the least, really. In his personal writings, where he was writing, for example, in his autobiography or in his diaries, you'll find lots of places where he says some really negative things about women. And a lot of those, you know, he is not very clear in his writing, but I think it's if you look at the total of his work, it seems like he's really criticizing the way women were in his time and place. And I think that he really recognized that you know, women didn't have to be the way they were in Victorian England, which was very repressed and you know, not educated. Unfortunately, a lot of women in that time and place didn't have much of an education, and I think that he really was critical of that. But in his spiritual writings and in his ritual and in his, you know, interpreting, for example, the Book of the Law, he was adamant that women and men are exactly identical in every respect except for our physiology. And he you know, in the Book of the Law, I think the first full, like, statement in the Book of the Law is every man and every woman is a star. And Crowley really championed that idea. And he considered himself, although some people might laugh to hear this, he considered himself to be the greatest feminist of his time. And he really, I think in some ways he was, because I think his idea of equality was much more radical than what a lot of people were talking about at the time. And to the extent, and I think in some ways his view of equality was even more radical than a lot of people see it today. But he really felt that that women and men at their core essence were identical, that in the core of our being is a star. And that star is, you know, the center of its own universe. And the fact that we have different organs of generation was just part of the way that our physical bodies manifested. Partly because of his bad relationship with his mother and because of the kind of the cultural problems that were in Victorian England, you know, really... women were treated as chattel still back then. But I think if, you know, Crowley saw a civilization where women weren't treated that way, he would have had the greatest respect for them. And throughout his life, he had, you know, he worked with women and accorded them the same level of development as any of the men that worked with him, in terms of, or not level of development, but level of authority within his orders. And OTO allows both women and men, as does AA allow both women and men, which is an improvement on a lot of the magical orders back then. You know, Freemasonry still doesn't allow women.
Hmm. Okay. Well, we got to take a quick break. We'll be back in 1 minute with Joseph Thebes, correct? Thebes?
Yes, that's right.
Thebes.
That's right.
All right.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, links section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And tonight on Where Did the Road Go, we've been talking to Joseph Thebes about Aleister Crowley. And one of the things I think a lot of people don't realize is Crowley had a great sense of humor.
Yeah, he really did. And you really find this when you read his books. And there's so much humor packed in every single one of his books. It's really hard to miss. And I think that, you know, sometimes people miss his jokes and they take something seriously. And because of that, it creates a myth about him. Like, for example, one of the funniest things I think he's ever written is the bit about sacrificing a male child, which I don't know if you're familiar with.
Oh,
that.
Oh, yeah, very much
it gets,
so.
It gets passed around the internet all the time as an example of Aleister Crowley sacrificed children, and he was such a horrible person. But, of course, Aleister Crowley would never sacrifice a child. And what he did was he wrote a lot of erotic poetry, and he was one of the first, you know, homoerotic poets to be published in the UK. Because back then, you know, being openly gay was you could be in prison for and doing hard labor if you were found out to be gay. And you know, Oscar Wilde died in prison around that time because of it. And Aleister Crowley was bisexual, and he wrote poetry, erotic poetry, both heterosexual and homosexual erotic poetry, and he tried to publish it, and he would publish it under pseudonyms, and he'd publish it in Amsterdam and then ship it over to the UK and things like that to kind of get around some of the laws. And they, you know, burned a couple of shipments of books. I know they burned almost all of the first printing of White Stains, which is a book of homoerotic poetry. And he, you know, as a joke, what he did was in his book Magic, he put... he has a chapter he talks about basically masturbatory ritual, doing sex magic, where it's you're masturbating instead of having sex with another person. You know, sex magic is a major part of the Western magical tradition, and Aleister Crowley, you know, had a lot to say about that subject. But he was concerned about the fact that, you know, anything really talking about sexuality was likely to get burnt because both the UK and the United States were so puritanical at the time. And so what he did was he referred to masturbation as child sacrifice. And it's really obvious if you read the whole chapter where that quote shows up, like it's really obvious that he's talking about masturbation. And that's why it's so funny when people throw around that quote, because it's like, You didn't read that. It's just, you know, that they didn't read the chapter if they think that actually means child sacrifice. But yeah, it's funny. So basically he's making a joke saying, okay, so the censors are going to let through something that says sacrifice children, but they won't let something through that even alludes to masturbation. So it was really kind of a commentary, both a political commentary and really funny joke.
And not only that, if he had actually killed that many children.
Yeah, right. He talks about killing, I don't remember exactly how many it was, but it worked out to basically one every couple days over the course of something like a decade. So, yeah, he would have been, you know, by an order of magnitude, the most prolific murderer of all time.
And yet,
no bodies though.
Yeah. One of my favorites, and I don't remember the exact details, is when he owned the place on Loch Ness, and he put up a sign, and the sign basically translated as "Beware of nothing." You remember this?
I hadn't heard that story, or I'd forgotten it. I don't remember. That's funny though. That makes sense.
It said "Beware of," and whatever word he used from whatever language just meant nothing, and people thought he had summoned a demon, and it was patrolling his property.
That's fantastic.
So, and I think a lot of people don't see that part of him because they look at him as this evil, satanic sort of, and even using the beast name, he was never a Satanist.
Right, exactly. He used the beast name, and I think really he saw that, you know, when you look at, like, for example, Revelation, I think he really thought that was a real prophecy about the future, and that what looked to John the Divine as a catastrophe actually turned out to be a liberation. And I think that's kind of what Crowley sees it as, is that it's more a matter of perspective than anything. And you think about what our current society has become, and, you know, what people at the time of John the Divine would have thought of it, and they would have been horrified. I mean, they wouldn't have even understood what was going on probably in the world. And it would have been terrifying to them. And so I think, you know, Aleister Crowley really claiming that idea of being the Beast, I think he thought of it more as being the role of the person who brings the next law to humanity rather than the person who is, you know, evil and destroys the old law.
He also kind of reveled in these misunderstandings, though, didn't he?
Yeah, he absolutely did. And I think that to a certain extent, he also felt that that was part of what would cause his message to spread, the controversy and the tabloid journalism would actually cause more people to become interested over time, because he noticed that, you know, what's that old saying? There's no such thing as bad publicity. That the more people talked about him in whatever light, the more people found out about Thelema and this teaching that we should all look toward our inmost nature to find what we should do in life rather than trying to adhere to some ancient code of morals. And so I think that he did revel in the controversy, and I think to a certain extent he enjoyed the limelight as well.
Okay. What about his political stance on things? This is part of the reason you made the AC 2012 page.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, the way that the AC 2012 came about, I was really disappointed in all of the options for president. Well, going back to the 90s, actually,
right.
I've never, you know, in my entire adult life, I've never actually voted for a Republican or a Democrat. For president anyway. I vote a little bit more seriously when it comes to the local elections and things like that. But for the president, I've for a long time felt that it kind of really it's a show. That it's the corporations that kind of, you know, use their lobbying budgets to kind of manipulate politicians into doing whatever they want. And I kind of see this happening on both sides of that political coin, and I also think that these sort of ideals that get set up, like democracy or I'm just trying to think, like all the political ideals of the two major parties or any political party really, they end up being kind of a thing that fascinates people and gets them to vote for something that then turns into something else. Like I really think that the ideals blind people to what really goes on in politics. If people get, you know, really loyal to their party, and they become very partisan, and they will attack each other, and in all that fighting, you know, the central message of what's really important gets lost. And I think that Aleister Crowley's political ideas, he actually has a number of political essays that he's written, and everything that he writes is really kind of grounded in the philosophy of his sort of new religion of Thelema. And what he says is that all of the political theories, whether it's democracy or communism or fascism or socialism, all these sort of idealistic political theories are really bankrupt when it comes down to it. And they can all be corrupted. They can all turn into a system of oppression. And likewise, they can all be used for good. Depending on how, you know, kind of what the guiding principle is of the people who are implementing it. And what he really championed was this idea that regardless of, you know, don't look at political ideals and say, you know, you're this label or you're that label. Look at individual policies in their time and place and see what is going to actually help people the most, you know, in that situation. And this is why we see, you know, Aleister Crowley would advocate, you know, things that seem maybe socialistic or communistic on the surface, like, you know, guaranteeing 6 months of welfare for all pregnant women, or things like that. And then on the other side, you see him railing against the idea of having traffic lights, traffic signals, because he felt that that was an encroachment on individual liberty. And so, like, really, I think that his perspective on politics kind of transcends what we're kind of indoctrinated to think of as the only political options or the only spectrum that there is. He kind of transcends that and says, no, all of that stuff is just talk, And what we really need to look at is a specific policy in a specific situation. And rather than saying, well, this policy is democratic, or this policy is really Republican, or this policy is communist, or this policy is socialist, and trying to make decisions based on that, you look at a policy and how it's going to actually affect people and whether or not that will be good or not, and then make a decision based on that.
So a very logical approach, basically.
Yeah.
somewhat libertarian, too.
Yeah, I think that libertarianism is probably the closest. If you were to try to pick a political party, libertarianism is probably the closest to Crowley. But libertarianism too doesn't quite do it, because again, there are things that help us as individuals to get along in the world, and like things like having socialized emergency response, for example, is pretty handy. And else, like I said, Aleister Crowley advocated 6 months welfare for women who are pregnant, which I don't think any libertarian would support that. But certainly Aleister Crowley would have advocated legalizing drug use, for example, which is a big libertarian platform.
Well, let's go on to his drug use real quick here. And he got, how did he start with the drugs?
Well, originally he had a bad case of bronchitis, and he had kind of respiratory issues going back to childhood. But he had bronchitis, and he was prescribed heroin, as you know would happen any time in those days, and became addicted to it through that.
Was around the 1900s, early around the turn of the century, wasn't it?
I don't recall exactly when he was originally prescribed heroin, but as time went on, I mean, he certainly experimented in other drugs. It's pretty likely that he experimented in, I'm pretty sure he did experiment with mescaline while he was in Mexico in, I don't remember the year. I'm never good with years. but in fact, there's a rumor. There's no way to really prove it one way or the other, but there is a rumor, because he did meet with Aldous Huxley at one point, and there's a rumor that he actually introduced Aldous Huxley to psychedelic mushrooms.
Wow.
He became addicted to heroin through medical use, but over time he became interested in both psychedelic, entheogenic use, as well as recreational use of drugs. And he tried a lot of different things, cocaine, heroin, mescaline, barbiturates, ether, you name it. If he could find it, he tried it.
Right.
So he
also, one of his sayings was kind of, if I get it right, the aim of religion with the method of science.
Right. He really sought to unite religion and science. And he thought that it was possible to have a religion that didn't defy the principles of science. And he, early on, before he received the Book of the Law, he actually wrote an essay called Science and Buddhism, where he saw Buddhism as a scientific religion. And, if you think about it, in a way, it could be considered that. I mean, it doesn't have any gods, for example. It doesn't tend to have many superstitions in it. So I think he really felt that it was important that these two things not be thought of as diametrically opposite, but that they could be united. And he also felt that, given certain drugs, you could stimulate religious experience. And I think he was speaking from experience at that point. And he wanted to see science working toward developing drugs that would help people to find their inmost nature through religious experience.
Okay. Now, he influenced so much stuff in our culture, and I don't think people are fully aware of the influence he has had.
It's really hard to even estimate the extent of his influence at this point. It starts with drug use and spirituality and bringing the East to the West. I mean, Aleister Crowley had a major role in all of those things. If you look at the whole hippie movement of the 1960s, Aleister Crowley had a major influence on that as well. The Beatles had him on their album. Timothy Leary saw himself and said on national television that he saw himself as somebody who's continuing the work of Aleister Crowley. Mm. Definitely had a major impact on civilization.
And, you know, even when you get down to little things like Ozzy writing a song about Crowley.
Right.
A very inaccurate song, in a yeah. sense. You know, very looking down on him. Bruce Dickinson was the same way. Bruce Dickinson wrote a song looking at him as a sad person, you know.
Yep.
That doesn't seem to be really the way he was.
No, there's a lot of music out there that really seems to be kind of ignorant about Aleister Crowley's real ideas and opinions, and people kind of just kind of went with this idea of him being a black magician and thought that that was the way it was. And it's, I think it's really comes down to the fact that there's that John Simons biography about Aleister Crowley where it says that at the end of his life he said something like, oh, what was it, I hate myself or
right.
whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, all that stuff was just, I mean, he just made that up. People who were actually at Crowley's deathbed said that nothing like that happened. And so, yeah, I think that a lot of the kind of the 1970s rockers who wrote songs about Aleister Crowley didn't know a lot about him. Jimmy Page would be an exception. I think Jimmy Page, you know, of Led Zeppelin, really studied Crowley. I don't think they wrote any songs about Crowley, but I think Jimmy Page knew and still knows about Aleister Crowley. He still follows Aleister Crowley's, you know, when Crowley's stuff comes up to auction, he's right there buying it, so.
And he also, he bought his house in Loch Ness.
Right, exactly, yep. But yeah, lots of people have written songs that mention Crowley, including David Bowie and Kate Bush and... or Kate Bush wrote a song that has, you know, Lester Banishing Ritual of the Pentagram embedded in it.
Really?
Yep. And actually, she has a music video that looks like it has Phyllis Seckler, somebody playing Phyllis Seckler, who was a later leader in the OTO and had her own magical order. There's somebody who looks very much like her in the music video that has the Banishing Ritual. I don't remember the song off the top of my head. I can email it to you later, though.
Huh. Okay, and I know like there are bands that are based wholly around Crowley's work, like Current 93.
Yes, absolutely. Current 93, and I don't know. There's you know, Coil has a lot of interest, or had a lot of interest in Crowley's work too, and occasionally had lines from his writings in there.
Fields of the Nephilim did the same thing. Carl McCoy was a big follower of Crowley.
Yeah.
So I mean, just on that, we have so much stuff from Crowley, and even the Wiccan religion. I mean, the Wiccan read, do what you will, but harm none, is kind of just a corruption of Crowley's, do as thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
Yes, absolutely. Gerald Gardner, who invented Wicca, was an initiate of Ordo Templi Orientis and knew Aleister Crowley personally. And if you actually look at the Book of Shadows, which if you look at Gardner's original rituals for the Gardnerian initiation rituals, he actually took pages of text directly from Aleister Crowley's writings and from the Book of the Law, and there's no denying it. I mean, it's just like you just look at them, compare one to the other, and it's almost word for word. And Doreen Valiente later went through and kind of revised everything so that it's not really exactly plagiarism anymore, but it's still the same ideas. I'd say Wicca is in many ways it's very close to Thelema, but it's been kind of
corrupted.
Made more I try to be polite and not say that, but yeah, watered down is another phrase.
Well, it you know, even that statement itself has changed the meaning. When you take out "do as thou wilt" and turn it into "you can do anything you want as long as you don't hurt anyone," that's not what "do as thou wilt" should be the whole of the law meant.
Right. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. I mean, there's sort of an implicit, like, you know, if you're interfering in somebody else's will, then you're keeping them from doing their will. So that means, you know, that's kind of contradicting the law already. So it's kind of like, it's already there. You don't need to say it in a way. So it seems to me that revising it, you know, not to mention the fact that the book itself specifically forbids revision, to revise it and add this additional little moral, like, by the way, don't hurt anyone. It's, you know, it's the first commandment. It just strikes me as kind of trying to appeal to mainstream culture. In a way that it almost feels to me like just another revision of Christianity, where you have everybody adhering to a moral guideline rather than trying to find their inmost nature. And I think you find when people say, do as thou wilt, and it harm none, they're a lot more focused on the and it harm none than they are on the, you know, what is my inmost nature.
Right, because it says kind of you can do whatever you want as long as you don't hurt anyone, as opposed to you should be following your true will.
Right, exactly. And the emphasis changes to a moral code rather than, a demand to take the inward journey and discover your inmost nature.
Okay, and how did Crowley die?
Oh, he died peacefully on his bed. He was staying at kind of an old folks' home, but it was small. It was mainly intellectuals staying there, and he wasn't feeling too well at the end of his life. I think it was just kind of like he died in his sleep. Nobody was in the room with him when it happened, but there were other people visiting him at the time. Patricia Deidre, I think is her name. She was there, and she said that around the time of his death, there was a peal of thunder in the distance, and he died quietly in his bed. And the days surrounding his death, or prior to his death, rather, there were children there, including his own child, Alistair Ataturk, and they were all, adoring him at the time. And it was just it was a quiet death, just old age.
Right, and so, that's one of those things. There are so many rumors about how he died, to the point where someone told me they once heard someone say that he was torn apart by demons.
Oh, jeez. Oh, people and their fantasies.
Well, I think that, that whole wickedest man in the world, where did that come from, the wickedest man in the world? That was saying a newspaper put on him, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. There was Crowley wrote these rites of Eleusis that were sort of dramatic rituals, and he kind of produced them and opened them up to the public, and he was hoping to kind of drum up some publicity for his magical orders. And so he invited some reporters to come and observe these rituals. And, there was incense, and it was dark, and there was, drumming, and all these things were kind of scandalous to have in Victorian society. And so the tabloids kind of ran with it, and that's where that came from, is one of the tabloids said that he was passing around drugs, which he wasn't, or he may have been, but they weren't, it would have been in the form of some kind of like a drink, and they would have been some kind of like probably a psychedelic drug that would have been used to enhance the experience rather than to, manipulate anyone or anything like that. And it would have been legal at that time, of course. But they, were of a different mind that he was, he was an evil sex magician and he had hypnotized women and all this horrible stuff. So they put that was where that came from. It was actually a tabloid that was really on the same level as the National Enquirer or the Weekly World News. It was called the John Bull, and they called him the wickedest man in the world. And boy, that stuck.
yes, it did. All right. Well, we're just about done for tonight. Maybe we could have you back on at some point.
I'd love to.
We've really just scratched the surface of Crowley and the different stuff he's done and taught.
It's true.
You have a podcast, though.
Yeah, I'd love to plug that. It's called The Speech in the Silence, and it's all Thelema all the time. So basically, it's various people talking about different magical teachings and Thelemic philosophy, as well as there's music on the show, and it's all from people who are Thelemites, and their music is oftentimes inspired by the teachings of Aleister Crowley. And there's also announcements and news, and that comes on once a month, and it's speechinthesilence.com.
Okay, all right. And what does Thelemite mean?
Thelema, the word Thelema is Greek. It comes from the Greek, which means will. So it's the idea is that somebody who's seeking to find and do their will.
Okay, all right. And that's kind of what he was all about in the end, is finding your true will.
Exactly right.
All right. Well, I thank you very much, Joseph.
Thanks for having me.
Fantastic hour. And we're going to start The Last Exit for the Lost, actually, with a bunch of music inspired by Crowley, including the infamous Mr. Crowley, or
Great.
Crowley, as Ozzy put it.
Yeah.
So, but we'll take you out with some Psyche Corporation. You're on WVBR-FM Ithaca. The Last Exit for the Lost is up next.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the note? discover your connection to perfection. I've aged the time you heard the singing soaking into our transmission. 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Counting. Can you?